well, but they weren't analyzing what was meant. And so I tried, you know, to bring some order to the disorders that existed. You know, that case was an interesting one for another reason. I wrote that case with a feeling that this is cut to a pattern. You know, you introduce the case, the facts, you identify the legal issue, you discuss the legal issue, you identify the facts of the legal issue in which you're competing. And we were doing that opinion after opinion after opinion. That's kind of boring. After the third or fourth year, you were writing the same sort of stuff. And I started experimenting with opinions. I remember one of the most gratifying approaches was to start with the discussion of the law and even identify the parties. This is a case that involves an issue of the presumption of undue influence, for example. Presumptions have been with us for many years. They include statutory presumptions, common law presumptions, evidentiary presumptions. These are the differences. We developed the general law that ultimately is applicable to this case. And then you begin discussing the facts of the case and the application of those facts of the law that we've already described. That was a far more gratifying way for me to write an opinion. I used it on occasion. I couldn't do it in all cases, of course. But it was a change of pace. And that helped.
I wanted to get you to express yourself some on your attitude toward I would say the excessive use by trial judges of the summary judgment rule, directed verdict, and that sort of thing.
I wrote an opinion in a case involving Dick Durant.
Was that the libel suit?
It was a case involving Larry Lindemann, George Beshara, Dick Van Dusen,
Stalen. Stalen versus
Durant versus Stalen. Then there was another companion case called Miller. It's in these materials that I gave you. In any event, what I tried to do there was to establish the ground rules for applying our 1963 court rules dealing with summary judgment. We had two types of summary judgments, only one of which really permitted examination of facts. Facts demonstrated by affidavit, by deposition transcript, by documentary evidence, things of that nature. And the only question was, were the facts material and were they in dispute? And if the answer to each of those questions was yes, then we could not grant summary judgment. It was a very simple concept, but trial judges had a great deal of difficulty applying it. And lawyers had a great deal of difficulty understanding.
Was your Winger case one such case?
No, that was a criminal case. I don't think that involved summary judgment. But in any event, we were, I think, successful for a while anyway in laying out the correct way to apply those two court rules in the different circumstances in which they applied. My concern about summary judgment was that in the earlier days, back in the 40s and early 50s, summary judgment was used to deny people the right to trial by jury. It was used to take back disputes away from juries and to favor, in the process, defendants. In the years that immediately preceded the Durant case, it seemed to me that trial judges had swung too far to the other side. They were afraid of granting summary judgment when summary judgment legitimately should have been granted because there was an absence of disputed fact that was material. And so what I tried to do in that decision, in those decisions, was to describe the process in such a way that it could be used legitimately, whether it meant taking a case away from a jury or whether it meant insisting that it be submitted to a jury. The jury trial issue is always a very troublesome one for me because I just had an abiding regard for trial by jury as one of the keystones of our system of government. That it troubled me that our court in the earlier years had undermined that right, as it did again, incidentally, when, in my view, it unjustifiably countenanced the reduction of the number of jurors from 12 to 6, when it permitted non-unanimous jury verdicts. I can't imagine anything more destructive about community value. That's what the jury is designed to provide, the judicial system. And when you say that 12 jurors can provide that as reliably as, I'm sorry, 6 jurors can provide that as reliably as 12, I don't think you know what you're talking about. It's as simple as that.
You, in speaking to the court in the Edwards portrait presentation, said this sentence, "Well, I regret sometimes deeply the role George and I both played in extending the right of discovery. Nonetheless, those rules without any doubt expose the opportunity to people and so on." What is your feeling as to where the discovery practice stands now? The rules to you
much broader than it should be. It has become a weapon rather than a shield. It has encouraged pleading cases that are non-existent until discovery reveals facts to support hunches. It encourages litigation in the sometimes frustrated, forlorn hope that facts will emerge to justify the allegation. It has been enormously expensive as an exercise. I've got a case over here that will cost litigants, all of them, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to try, because the discovery process is so pervasive in this country today, and because it is so readily available to litigants, they want to know all there is to know about every aspect of the controversy, even the obviously immaterial, on the off chance that they might discover something that is relevant. And it's just prohibitively expensive. It has changed the face of the practice of law. It has changed the face of the profession.